We now want to jump and talk about a slightly different but very important topic. The topic is understanding statistical inference. Statistical inference is how we make decisions in statistics. I want you to pause and understand why we have statistics. Statistics is supposed to help us decide what is reality. Think about statistics as the referee in this game of science that we're playing. Trying to decide what is real or what is not real comes to us not by our subjective impressions, but by the rules laid down by this procedure we call statistical inference. When I was an undergraduate, for a while, a couple of months anyhow, I toyed with the idea of being a philosophy major. I soon decided no. You know why I decided no? Because in philosophy, they never decide anything. They're still arguing now about things they were arguing about 5,000 years ago. Nothing ever gets decided. But science is supposed to make decisions and advance based on the realities that we understand to be true. How do we understand and how do we establish those realities? That's what statistics is about. Think about statistics this way. You're at a basketball game. It's a great game, it's going along, and suddenly, tweet, the whistle blows. Play stops. The game is reset based on what the referee says and then goes forward again. In the game of basketball, reality is set not by what actually happens, but by what the referee says happens. And statistics is basically our referee in science. Now, as anyone that's ever watched a basketball game knows, the referee is not always right. Sometimes the referee tweet, blows the whistle, makes a call. Instant replay shows there was no foul, but you know what? We reset and we go forward just as if the referee was correct. Sometimes you're watching the game, one of the players gets an elbow on the side of the head, goes sprawling across the court, a flagrant foul, the referee doesn't see it, and the play proceeds as if it never happened. Because reality is not what actually happened, reality is the call the referee makes. The referee in our game of science is statistics. And by giving you this example at the outset, I'm trying to get you to understand at the outset this simple idea. We are going to assume that reality is what the referee says, but we never want you to forget the referee can be wrong. Sometimes statistics says something matters and it really doesn't. Sometimes statistics says something doesn't matter and it really does. We always must be cognizant of this process. If you're confused about how statistics works, well, many people seem to be, but if you're confused, it's because you're really not focusing on two key propositions. Here are the key propositions. One, in statistics, everything is exactly ass backwards from the way you think it is. Yes, you heard me correctly. See, the problem is as follows. In statistics, you can't prove anything. All you can ever do is disprove something. So therefore, the only way to prove something is to disprove its opposite. If I want to show the drug works, I can't do that, but I can disprove the proposition the drug doesn't work. Does that sound like a double negative to anybody? Yes? Then you're following me. Double negatives are terrible English, but they're great statistics. It's how the process works. Second, never forget that statistics does not deal in reality. Statistics deals in data. And so at the end of the process, there's always that final leap from what the data say to an inference to what's true out there in the real world. With those two bookends, let's work through an example talking about trying to demonstrate how the logic of statistics works. Congratulate me. I've just been given a tremendous sum of money by the Pharmacia Corporation to test their brand new anti-diarrhea medication, Kaopectate 9. They're expecting great things out of Kaopectate 9. They even have a publicity campaign all dreamed up. I think the slogan's going to be, "We stop you up so you can get going." Kind of clever, isn't it? But we don't get to actually use that slogan until we show the drug actually works. And so, here's my research design. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for volunteering. You're now all members of my research study. Poof. You now all have massive explosive diarrhea. Don't leave your chair. Over here on this side, randomly selected in this double-blind study, this group of people with diarrhea is going to get the wonder drug Kaopectate 9. Over here on this side, double-blind randomized study, this group of people is going to get, unbeknownst to them, placebo. Sorry about that. And now we're going to follow both groups forward in time and see how long it is until we have cessation of diarrhea, as signified perhaps by two solid stools in a row. Before we go forward, stop for a moment. What do you think? Good study? Anything wrong with the study we need to fix, change, modify? Actually, the study's fine. It's simple, but good study designs are simple because it lets you see the relationships cleanly. Two groups, both with diarrhea. One gets the drug, one doesn't get the drug. We're going to wait and see what the outcome is. A very simple design. Okay. Now, to do our statistics, we have to begin by defining the proposition we're going to test with the statistics. The proposition we're going to test has a name. It's called the null hypothesis. In order to get the null hypothesis, we'll invoke the first rule that I talked about. It's going to be the opposite of what it is you want to show. So if I want to show that the drug works, the null hypothesis is going to be the opposite. The drug doesn't work. Now, there are two types of null hypotheses, one-tailed and two-tailed. It's important that you understand the distinction between them. And so let's look at each one of these in turn. In order to demonstrate this issue, let's back away from the diarrhea study. Back you away from diarrhea. That's a good idea anyhow. And let's focus on something a little bit easier. Let's focus on something simple, comparing the heights of men and women. Here's a distribution of the heights of men here in the center. Now, here are the logical possibilities. Women could be the same as men, or women could be taller, or women could be shorter. Those are all the logical possibilities. Consider the following proposition. Men and women are the same height. Men and women are the same height. How many ways can I disprove? How many ways can I demonstrate that proposition is wrong? Well, if women are taller, it's wrong. If women are shorter, it's wrong. How many ways can I disprove that proposition? Two. This is therefore a two-tailed null hypothesis. Why is it two-tailed? Because there's two ways to disprove it. Taller than disproves it and shorter than disproves it. Either way disproves the proposition. Let's compare that to a different proposition. The proposition, men are not taller than women. Men are not taller than women. How many ways can I disprove that proposition? Well, suppose women are taller than men. Doesn't matter, does it? Suppose women are shorter than men. That disproves the proposition. How many ways can I disprove this? One. It's therefore a one-tailed null hypothesis. One-tailed. Why is it one-tailed? Because there's only one way to disprove it. If you find yourself saying, on one hand or on the other hand, I would reject the hypothesis, then it's two-tailed. If you find yourself saying just greater than, or alternatively, just less than, it's one-tailed. Okay, with that in front of us, let's return to our diarrhea study. Back to the diarrhea study. Ladies and gentlemen, I need some advice out there. I need some advice. What kind of null hypothesis would you have me use here? One-tailed or two-tailed? Well, I could use the proposition, the drug has no effect on diarrhea, which I'd reject if it makes diarrhea better or if it makes diarrhea worse. That's a two-tailed proposition. I'm not interested in testing that. What I'm interested in testing is whether or not it makes diarrhea better. The null hypothesis, the drug fails to help people with diarrhea get better sooner, is my choice. And that is a one-tailed null hypothesis. I'm going to show it helps people get better, and that's only a one-tailed issue. Therefore, that's the null hypothesis I'm going to adopt here. The drug fails to help people with diarrhea get better sooner than people that don't take the drug. With that null hypothesis in place, now what? Well, now I conduct my research. I follow both groups forward in time. I see how long it is until we have cessation of diarrhea, as signified perhaps by two solid stools in a row. And then what? Well, then all the data goes into the computer. Now, things happen to the data in the computer, important things, but not tested things. As far as you're concerned, what happens inside the computer is just a black box. What you should be concerned about for your step one exam is not what happens in the computer, it's what comes out of the computer. Well, what comes out of the computer is a whole lot of information. You're going to get a lot of letters. You're going to get things like R's and a correlation coefficient. You're going to get T as in a T test. You're going to get F as in an F test. Or you're going to get even Greek letters as in chi-squared. When you see these letters on the exam, this is what's important. This is what you must do with them. Ignore them. Forget about them. They will not help you get a single question right on this exam. There's one and only one letter we want you to focus on. Come on, you know what that letter is. It's the P value. It's the P value. The P value, ladies and gentlemen, in this context, has nothing whatsoever to do with urology, but has everything to do with how we make statistical decisions. It's all about making decisions. If you use statistics correctly, you don't really have to worry and make decisions for yourself. They're already being made for you. All you have to do is follow the mechanical procedure. Now, if you're confused about how the p-value works, and many people are, it's probably for this reason. We talk about the p-value, we're not really talking about one, but in fact two separate things. And we need to have you parse those two things out and understand how they work when they come back together. Let's begin by reminding you that the p-value is about making decisions. And so let's pause and understand how it is that we make decisions. We make decisions by first setting a proposition in place and then comparing empirical data to the proposition and reaching our conclusion accordingly. Okay, hey, let's go on a picnic tomorrow. Wouldn't that be fun? A picnic, yay! But let's agree between the two of us right now, if it's raining, we won't go. Now there's a clear proposition in place. If it's raining, we won't go. Now, tomorrow comes. And tomorrow comes and we look at the empirical data. It's raining. It's raining, therefore compared to this standard, we don't go. Tomorrow comes, it's a bright sunny day. It's bright sunny day, therefore we do go. The decision I make is merely what the empirical data are compared to this pre-existing standard, and the decision is made mechanically for me. The p-value is both of these things. The p-value is this criterion, and it is also the empirical data. Think about the first set kind of p-value this way. It's the alpha criterion. It's a bar. It's a standard that we're going to use for our decision. Now, this is not a bar in the sense of a hurdle we're trying to jump over. This is a bar in the sense of the limbo bar. You're trying to go underneath it. I could set this bar high or low at my discretion, but most commonly, most often, we set it at a customary level, p less than or equal to 0.05. Why do we use that level? It's tradition. Why fight tradition, right? Well, here's the real reason. Would you like to get your article published? If you'd like to get your article published, this is the criterion that most editors will hold you to. And so it's become the de facto standard. Now notice, this p-value criterion, this alpha criterion, was put in place before we ever conducted the research. What we're now going to do is look at what comes out of the computer, what we call the computed or the empirical p-value. We're going to take that empirical p-value and compare it to the standard to make our decision. Here are some possible outcomes from our research. Suppose my empirical p-value is as follows, p equals 0.02. P equals 0.02, that's now below the bar, yes? Yes. And so by simple mechanical illustration, I'm now going to reject the null hypothesis written as H naught. Why? Because I'm lower than the bar. It's as simple as that. Now, have I done the right thing? Well, I've done exactly what my data told me to do. Here's the bar, I'm below it. I rejected the null hypothesis. When I reject the null hypothesis, what does that mean? Does that mean the drug works or the drug doesn't work? Well, I ask you to recall the null hypothesis was the opposite of what we were looking for. So rejecting the null hypothesis means I'm rejecting the proposition the drug doesn't work, meaning I'm left with the proposition the drug does work. Rejecting the null hypothesis is then a general good thing. It means I'm happy, I've now shown the drug likely works. But there's one minor wrinkle. You see, in the data, the drug works. The conclusion I reached, the drug works, is true for the data, but is it true for the whole wide world out there? If it works in the data, but it doesn't work in the whole wide world, then when I reach the conclusion to reject the null hypothesis, I made a mistake. I made an error. I made what we call a type 1 or alpha error. Type 1 or alpha error. Type 1 or alpha error simply means this. I rejected the null hypothesis, but I shouldn't have. I decided the drug works, and you know what? No, doesn't really. Here's the problem. I never know for sure if I made a type 1 error. I never know if I actually made a type 1 error or not. All I do know is the chance or the probability that I made a type 1 error. What's the chance? Read it right here, the p-value. The p-value equals 0.02. What does that mean? If I reject the null hypothesis, that means 2 times out of 100 I've done the wrong thing. Now, if doing the wrong thing makes you nervous, look at it the other way. That means 98% of the time you've done the right thing. If I were to tell you all that if you buy a lotto ticket in the next hour, you have a 98% chance of winning, that would pretty much clear the room, right? 98% chance of being right, that's a pretty good chance of being right. You only have a 2% chance of being wrong, those are pretty good odds. I'll take those odds. Basically, all we're saying here with this computed p-value is the chance of a type 1 error. And when the chance of a type 1 error gets low enough, I take the risk and reject the null hypothesis. How low is low enough? That's what the p-value criterion is, traditionally below 0.05. This is one possible set of outcomes from my research. Here's another. P equals 0.16. P equals 0.16. What I have here is a p-value that is above the criterion. I'm above the criterion, therefore, I do not reject the null hypothesis. Notice what my options are here. My options are to reject or to fail to reject. Please note, I do not have an option to accept the null hypothesis. It's either rejected or fail to be rejected. The logic here is the same logic that a jury uses in a court of law. The jury is asked to find the defendant guilty or not guilty. No jury ever finds anybody innocent. That's not their job. Now, I did not reject the null hypothesis. Okay. What's the chance that I made a type 1 error? Answer, zero. Why? Well, because in order to make a type 1 error, I must first do what? Reject the null hypothesis. I did not reject the null hypothesis, therefore, the chance of a type 1 error is zero. Now, does that mean I'm error-free? Does that mean I'm successful and I've done nothing wrong? No, I'm still vulnerable to a different kind of error, a type 2 or beta error. Type 2 or beta error simply means I did not reject the null hypothesis, but I should have. That means based on my data, I decided the drug doesn't work. And you know what? It's really a good drug. Out here in the real world, this would be a great thing to have. Everyone wants it. And you know what? My data say that's not correct. Once again, error is when the data do not agree with reality out here. Since I didn't reject the null hypothesis, the error I might have made is a type 2 error. Based on the information presented here above the line, what's the chance that I made a type 2 error? Answer, I don't know. I haven't the vaguest idea, and you don't either. The point here is important. I do not want you looking to the p-value for the chance of a type 2 error. It is not. The p-value is about what type of error only? Type 1 error only. Not type 2, just type 1. Now, there is a way to figure out the chance of a type 2 error. It's related to something called statistical power. Now, statistical power is actually a fairly complex conceptual issue. For the exam, I'm going to try to limit you to two important pieces of knowledge. One, power is related to type 2 error by the following simple equation. 1 minus power equals beta. Or 1 minus beta equals power. Or power plus beta equals 1. I don't care how you remember it. Any version of that is fine. The only way on the step 1 exam you might be asked to compute a type 2 error is if they give you the power of the test. If the power is 80%, the chance of a type 2 error is, of course, 20%. The other thing we want you to know about statistical power is simply this. What's one simple thing you can do to increase power and thereby reduce the chance of a type 2 error? Easy. Increase your sample size. Increasing sample size will increase your power, which correspondingly will reduce the chance of type 2 error. And that's the logic of statistics. All laid out with all the real possibilities. Let's review. We set a standard, a p-value criterion, before the research. I then get a computed p-value. If it's below the line, I reject the null hypothesis, knowing I might have made a type 1 error. If it's above the line, I do not reject the null hypothesis, knowing I might have made a type 2 error. It's that simple. It's that mechanical. It's yes or no. The referee blows the whistle, and here's your call. Let's review a few other things that I want to make sure you're clear on. Which is worse, type 1 or type 2 error? Which is worse? Well, folks, although there's some debate, we generally say in medicine a type 1 error is worse. Why? Well, think about it this way. If you're Catholic, or even if you're not, the Catholics talk about two kinds of errors. There's sins of commission, looking you in the eye and lying. And there's sins of omission, that is just forgetting to tell you something. Which is worse, doing something I shouldn't do or forgetting to do something? Which, well, we usually say the sin of commission is worse. It's worse to look you in the eye and actually give a lie. It's worse to tell people the drug is a good one and have everybody using it when it's in fact not, than it is to not have people taking a drug that might help them. Because the oath says, first, do no harm. Type 2 error at least doesn't do any harm. Consider the following. Ladies and gentlemen, I've come before you here to make a statement today. Thank you all for coming, members of the press. I wish to read my statement. Ladies and gentlemen, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Monica Lewinsky. What kind of error is that? Type 1 error, big type 1 error. It's a lie, it's a statement of non-truth. Type 1 error is usually considered worse. Now, let's suppose the results you got were down here at the bottom. Let's suppose the results you got were down here below the bar. P equals 0.02, you rejected the null hypothesis. Hooray! I get to decide the drug works. So now, a patient comes in to see me with severe diarrhea. And so now, well, now I'm going to give them this kaopectate 9 drug. The patient looks at the prescription, looks at me, looks at the prescription, looks at me, and says, Doc, I know this drug worked in the research, but what's the chance this drug will work for me? What's the chance this drug will actually help me get better? Based on the data presented here, my best response to the patient is what? Here's your best response. I have no idea, because you have nothing here that gives you that information. The p-value tells you statistical significance. It does not tell you clinical significance. The p-value does not tell you, in other words, the chance that an individual patient will benefit, does not tell you the number of patients who will get better, does not tell you the amount of symptom relief an individual patient will get. No, absolutely no. Do not look at this and say 98% of the patients get better on this drug. That's not what the p-value means. That's a wrong answer. We're trying to get you to avoid marking that on your step one exam. All the p-value tells you is the chance that you're wrong if you reject the null hypothesis, period.